Times change. You got to keep up with the times. That's what Kaizen is trying to do. Improve every day, either a little bit or a lot. Doesn't matter, but improve every day. What people tend to focus on is the behaviors, and that's a mistake. It's not gotten us really anywhere in the last 100 years when people started to focus on leadership behaviors and what are the requisite behaviors. And I've been pushing people forward. It's like, you need to look at the preconceptions because we've been doing this behavior stuff for better than a century, and you still have leadership in corporations that a lot of people are dissatisfied with.
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple: to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. I am your host, Keith Norris. Our guest today is Dr. Bob Miliani. Bob brings over 30 years of progressive management experience to the conversation today. He's a former engineering, manufacturing, and supply chain leader. Bob helped establish the Toyota production system at Pratt & Whitney before transitioning into academia, where he spent 20 as the pioneering lean leadership researcher. Now, Professor Emeritus, he has authored 28 books and numerous peer-reviewed papers across six disciplines, earning recognition as one of the field's most original and influential thinkers. Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, it's awesome. As we've been, you know, getting prepped for this conversation, I've been following more of your stuff on LinkedIn, and I was able to pick up at least one of your books. I wasn't quite sure where to start, so I'm sure I'll have some other insights after our conversation today. But one of the things that we like to start with typically on this podcast is a little segment we call the spark. And what I find is people that are kind of bit by this bug, a lot of times there's like a moment that they remember early on. I'm curious, you know, it goes back a while. You spent more time thinking about lean than a lot of people have spent, in some areas. So what was the start for you?
Well, initially, I was working in the engineering organization of Pratt & Whitney, and they had a library. And for some reason, I checked out the book, Gemba Kaizen. And it didn't make, you know, I was in engineering at the time, working in new product development and so forth. I read the book and it, you know, it wasn't really so relevant, or I couldn't understand the relevancy. But I ended up shortly thereafter moving from engineering to operations at Pratt & Whitney. So it was a move in location. And within a week or two of my arrival as a business unit manager, the business unit I was responsible for was engaged in Kaizen with Shingijutsu. And that was the summer of 1994. It was July 1994. So I was learning a Toyota production system from Shingijutsu while I was at Pratt & Whitney. And so I was curious about it. Having read that book, I wanted to participate in Kaizen. And I did as a team member, not as a team leader, because I didn't know anything about it. And then I participated in a bunch of other Kaizens. And then when I had sufficient capability, I became a team leader of some Kaizens as well. And so that was the start of it. It was summer 1994, learning TPS with the assistance of the wonderful Shingijutsu Kaizen consultants.
Interesting. And you've written so many books on the topic and subject matter since. I hope to understand a little bit about the journey and the evolution. You obviously are quite a historian on just this discipline of lean. I want to start by just establishing a little bit of language and context for folks. Because I think like, what does lean mean? Lean in the greater context of progressive management. Maybe you could just give us a little bit of like a mental model for how to think about these.
Sure. Originally, back in the fall of 1988, when the term lean came to the forefront in the business community as a result of a research project at MIT, it was not defined in the original paper by John Krafcik what lean was, and it was just taken to be the generic term to describe Toyota's production system. And at the time, it was called lean production. And it remained that phrase, lean production, until 2010, when there was a meeting at the Lean Enterprise Institute for their, maybe it was 2007, for their 10th anniversary. Among the suggestions from the participants, myself included, was we should move away from the term lean production to lean management, because as the author Yasuhiro Mandan, as he noted in one of his books, that Toyota, it's a management system. It's not just a production system, although Toyota people refer to it as Toyota production system, but it's really essential for their overall management system. So anyway, it's supposed to be a generic term, but then lean kind of morphed and evolved into being its own thing, somewhat divorced from Toyota's management system. While lean people really love Toyota, there are substantial differences between lean and Toyota's management system. Substantial differences. So they are not the same thing, unlike what some people think.
So lean is maybe a derivative, but is kind of taken on its own place in the culture currently,
yes,
I guess.
I would characterize it as a Western derivative interpretation of Toyota's production system up to about 2007, and then after that, their management system, once the people who promote lean became aware of the Toyota Way 2001, which highlighted the Toyota Way as Kaizen and respect for people, although it was mistranslated as, well, it was mistranslated for some reason by Toyota as continuous improvement and respect for people, but in the Japanese version, it's Kaizen and respect for humanity. So go figure.
I love it. These are so interesting, you know, like these concepts that, you know, there's so much debate about what lean is and what lean isn't, and is it the same or is it different? So I love talking to someone who's, you know, understands the history and when these things diverted. It's quite interesting. Yeah. You use this term progressive management also, yep, in your work. Tell us how to think about that versus these other terms.
Yeah. So I, you know, what people would normally consider the old way of doing things or how it's always done and so forth, has, I call it classical management, and that has ancient origins. I mean, it goes back to times of ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia before that. And so a lot of those same ways of thinking are with business today. And while, of course, back then you had kings and rulers who were concerned about the state and so forth, business comes from those people who gave the kings and rulers who gave people, typically their lords, the right to conduct some business on their behalf, some commercial business enterprise on behalf of the pharaoh, the king, the queen, the ruler, whoever. And so some of those ways of thinking still exist. You can imagine when a lousy pyramid got built in Egypt that the pharaoh would be blaming the architect and or the engineer. And today when there's a problem in a company, what happens? You blame somebody for the problem. So some of these ways of thinking are still with us today. And I tell people, it's not that long ago, you know, it's 175 generations to ancient Egypt. It's 15, I believe it's 15 or 17 generations to King Henry VIII. So, you know, we're humans. We still think a lot of the same ways as those folks did way back when.
I think it's very interesting that you're drawing this like evolutionary picture of, yeah, of management generally. So you're describing progressive management as like where we're at currently with that,
nope,
that evolution of management?
No, progressive management. No, because classical management, while it has evolved, it's remained in fundamental ways largely the same. What I refer to as progressive management is something that's different than the old way of doing things, different than classical management. We're progressing away from the old way of doing things. So it's not political progressiveness that we're talking about here. It is progressive in terms of its breaks with the traditions of the old way of doing things. And that's hard to do, to break those traditions.
So would you say that progressive management is on one end of the spectrum and classical management is on the other? Or is there like a kind of a line between,
yeah,
the two?
No, they're pretty significantly different like that. And so in the modern times, progressive management begins within the U.S., anyway, post the World War II, what's called systematic, although management was largely the same under what's called systematic management, which was post-Civil War, but around 1890, 1900, with Frederick Winslow Taylor and his folks in scientific management, that would be the marking of the modern progressive management movement. And then Toyota's production system, of course, is built heavily on the result of Taylor's work and others, his colleagues, who created industrial engineering. And so, of course, the Toyota people, very intelligent, added many of their own ideas and simplified a lot of things, and made it much more practical and useful and so forth. So it's a, you know, synthesis. They built on Taylor's work in a very, very, very good way.
Yeah. So you're, again, I love that you're such a historian of management in general. You know, for anybody that isn't as familiar with some of these significant milestones, I'm curious if you could, you know, maybe point out some of the more significant shifts in thinking. You mentioned like Frederick Taylor and Toyota, but what are some of the ones that you think are most notable for people interested in the understanding of the history of this?
Well, I mean, you know, things build off of one another. So there's systematic management. There's the work of Taylor and his colleagues. And I add his colleagues because there were very important contributors within his group of people to the creation of industrial engineering. But what happened to Taylor's work is most of it got treated as tools, which got absorbed within the framework of traditional classical management. And of course, that's what we have with Lean as well. As the tools get absorbed into classical management and what I termed 25 years ago as fake lean. And so there was such a thing as fake scientific management too. Taylor and his crowd referred to the opportunists in that world as being fakers and charlatans and so forth, because basically they would go in and improve something and lay off a bunch of people as a result of the improvement. And so, you know, in Taylor's day, shortly after he died, they were more focused on the words continuous improvement started to show up, and they were also engaging operators in improvement. And there's a lot of misconception about that, that people think that scientific management was just, you know, making people like robots, telling them what to do. But like anything, scientific management evolved. And then Toyota did a lot better job with that, you know, and how they treat people.
Was it Taylor? I remember a story of somebody who the topic was like the size of shovel, right? Like what's the perfect
size? That was Taylor. Yeah, that was part of Taylor's studies. Yeah.
Okay. And the idea there is that he did a bunch of research into like what's the best size for a shovel to, I don't know,
that's
optimize
correct. It. So you wouldn't have operator fatigue and so forth, but they could shovel the most amount of coal per day. Yeah, and some people have criticized that study, and that comes from the book Scientific Management, authored by Taylor, but it was ghostwritten by Morris Cook. And so somebody, you know, probably looked at the numbers in that, and not probably, they did look at the numbers at that and say it didn't make sense that it was this size shovel and so forth, but whatever, it is what it is now, so.
Well, and I know that Ford and the assembly line is oftentimes referenced in terms of like evolutionary of management and Toyota. You mentioned something about the continuous improvement phrase or term. Where did that first show up?
In the days of scientific management, it could have showed up, you know, it's a big world, could have shown up in, you know, in Poland or wherever, I don't know, France, you know, a long time ago. In the early 1900s, late 1800s, could have showed up in the 1500s for all we know. Maybe the engineer of the pyramids thought the same, used the same term somewhere. So that's not really sort of the distinguishing characteristic. What really is the difference between Kaizen and continuous improvement. Because Kaizen is a very creative activity, whereas continuous improvement may or may not be, depending on how people teach that. And so there's substantial
difference.
Explain
what you mean by that.
Well, one of the challenges in Kaizen is to make improvements without using any new resources. So no more people, no new software, no new buildings, you know, no more square footage, no new equipment. And it involves a lot of times just making equipment out of found material. You know, and also, you know, downsizing the equipment. If the part you're making is 6 inches in diameter, why do you need a big, huge machining center? Why don't you have a machine that's small envelope? There's a whole host of way of thinking, tricks, ideas, and so forth. And I'll just give you one quickly. A lot of people are easily sold by salespeople to get a big machine tool. And the owners of the companies don't challenge the engineers and the operators and other people there to design and build their own equipment. And if you design and build your own equipment out of found materials primarily, or things that you could get from the Granger catalog and expense, not capitalize, then you basically have a piece of equipment that's not taxed. And, you know, what are owners always talking about? I hate taxes and our costs are too high. So why are you buying you know, the 200,000, $1 million machine, when you can make many of those, not all of them yourself, or you can buy the parts of the machine you need, called a naked machine, and add in the pieces yourself. So instead of buying the $2 million piece of equipment from the machine tool maker, you say, I want the base and I want the motor and this and that. Okay, now it's $1 million. So your capital expense and taxes are based upon that $1 million rather than the $2 million. And your engineers and operators and whatever figure out how to fill in the rest of the pieces, unique to your needs in that company. And of course, save a lot on taxes, you've reduced your capital outlay, which is probably some loan that you're paying interest on, and so on and so on. That stuff doesn't come up in continuous improvement, but it does come up in Toyota's Kaizen methods.
I do find that interesting, the creativity element that you just referred to. It is interesting how often when in my world we talk about business improvement and the things that people are doing, how often the knee-jerk reaction is spend some large amount of money to do this.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
And I think what you're pointing out is the discipline of creativity and working within some constraints can really yield a lot of benefit.
Well, also, people don't think they have the capability to do this stuff, and management doesn't think they have it either. So you go call the people who sell the equipment and bring them into the company and hire the specialists.
Yeah, always looking for something external to solve the problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of companies that the leaders have very low-level confidence in the employees. They look at them as the people who make mistakes, the people who are costing me money, the people who are not working hard enough, the people who are hiding problems, the people who are stealing from me. So when you have that attitude, you're not going to see any creativity in your people beyond your imagined, theft of things.
Yeah, that's one of the reoccurring themes in this discipline is asking for the ideas and the creativity from the existing people. So I think that's such a good insight. So I have a question about the way of thinking about lean. You know, sometimes I'll see these debates about lean's not a strategy, it's an operating system, or it's not a set of tools, it's something else. Like, what is lean? Is it a strategy? Is it an operating system? Is it
it's
a theory?
It's not a strategy. Here's what happens is, the same thing happened with scientific management, you know, when the idea and associated method doesn't sell well in the marketplace, people then write books about, do this stuff and you'll get more profits. And then when that doesn't really sell well, they escalate and say, it's now a strategy. You know, it's all of this effort to gain the interest of the CEO to be able to convince them. You know, if you're in the case of Taylor and his folks, they were trying to improve the output of companies to satisfy demand in the marketplace. It was a seller's market. So the reason they were making these kinds of improvements in how work was performed, so a company could output, you know, 100,000 units because there was demand for that instead of 50,000. What they didn't understand, though, was the owner would rather produce 50,000 so they can keep the price high rather than produce 100,000 price. But anyway, different story. You know, neither a corporate strategy nor a business strategy for a company that's producing a product or service. If you're selling lean, then lean is your strategy because that's what you're selling. But if you're producing a widget or a hotel or whatever, it's not a strategy. At best, you could call it an operation strategy for the operating part of the business. It obviously applies elsewhere to all parts of the business. But it's the wrong debate to have. You don't see anywhere where Toyota says this is a strategy.
So let's say the executive, senior executives, how would you suggest we or they think about lean? Like how should we position it in our heads as something to keep in mind?
Well, they position in their heads that it's not necessary for the most part. What most CEOs will say, what we got going is good enough. Classical management works. There's a long tradition. We should respect tradition. We shouldn't change things for the sake of changing things. Yeah, the lean world has some interesting tools which we can absorb. And let's do that. Let's absorb those tools and let people at lower levels use those tools. High up, we're not going to bother with that stuff because we have different concerns. We have a corporate strategy. You know, what business are we in? We have our business strategy. What are we going to make? What are we going to sell? You know, they're thinking about different things. They're thinking about how are we going to raise prices? What competitors can we buy? to reduce market, you know, to gain market share and so forth and reduce competition. So they're thinking about different things. And that's one of the things the lean world doesn't want to acknowledge, that they think that just this notion of improvement and, you know, continuous improvement and respect for people sells itself, and it doesn't. We're 37 years into this, you know.
Yeah, it's not exactly brand new, is it?
Not exactly brand new, and it's also not exactly popular amongst, especially big company CEOs pretty much ignore it. There's outliers like GE CEO, names escape me at the moment, GE Aerospace CEO, Larry Cope.
Okay. So, in terms of how it's positioned, I mean, there is this scenario in a lot of companies where, whether you call it lean or continuous improvement, it does get set up as like a cost savings, you know, a way of finding cost savings, and a lot of times gets turned into very specific projects or initiatives. You know, some people would say that, you know, okay, lean is, it's a department, it's an initiative, it's a project. I'm thinking that you probably have some opinions on that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, cost savings is important if you're in a competitive marketplace. That's just reality, you know, so you always have to be concerned about that. The question is, how do you go about doing your cost savings? Do you just offshore work? You know, do you lay people off? Do you outsource work? What is your approach to doing that? And what do you gain and what do you lose when you do that? And of course, there's a lot of poor decision making in terms of understanding the gains and the losses. If you're in a non-competitive marketplace, kind of like where you have a you know, monopoly on the drug that you're selling and so forth, well then, you know, it's probably not going to really bother with lean because you can get your price, so who cares? When people, yeah, they turn it into a program, they turn it into an initiative and so forth, and it just usually doesn't work out that way, because generally speaking, when top leaders announce we're going to do this lean stuff, they don't give a good explanation of why we're doing it, other than to say, it's a competitive market, our costs are high, and this stuff doesn't resonate with somebody seven layers down. They're like, what do I got to do differently in my job? And it's not clear. And then when they figure it out, you know, do setup reduction and reduce the queue time between steps and so forth and balance the workloads. And it turns out now we need four people instead of seven and three get laid off. And that just kills the whole thing right there.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I want to dive into there. One of them, of course, there's the, you know, if you focus on lean as a cost reduction initiative program, fill the word in right here, you end up with this excess labor sometimes. And as somebody who spent so much time thinking about lean, I know that you've got an opinion on that as the right or wrong way to do things. Where are people missing the big picture when they look at lean as just a cost reduction strategy or laying people off?
So, if you go back to, for example, Taichi Ono's writing, he talks a lot about TPS cost reduction and so forth. But what gets lost in that conversation that's not immediately apparent or so apparent in the books that he wrote, in other words, it's there, but it doesn't jump out at you so much, is all the worker training that goes into the suggestion system to get workers to offer suggestions for improvement and cost reduction, other types of training, as well as the creativity associated with Kaizen. So when you just look at lean, or you try to emulate Toyota's production system or their management system as just, you know, a pure cost reduction exercise, you do not understand the training and the creativity, for example, that Toyota and a few lean exemplars out there do, so that those people are more valuable and you don't want to lose them. You want to keep them, which puts pressure on management to sell the product and come up with new product ideas and so on. So there's large misunderstandings about people, cost reduction, we'll say continuous improvement. And that's part of the problem. If the understanding was people, cost reduction, and creative Kaizen plus training, it'd be different. But in classical management, the bosses don't care about any of that.
In classical management, what do the bosses care about?
They're very bottom line oriented, but more than that, they're very oriented towards their own social standing. So a lot of what you see that goes on in classical management is basically social competition between that level of CEO and so forth.
Do phrases like, I don't know, climbing the corporate ladder or maintaining the status quo, does that
yeah.
kind of...
Yep, yep. I mean, they can make a very good case that classical management has been wonderful. It's produced good results for people globally, you know, taking them out of poverty, et cetera. It's another thing lean people don't understand is what the counter argument is that the leaders who stick with classical management have, and the lean people just, you know, they just ignore it like it doesn't exist and say, well, no, you got to do this continuous improvement and respect for people. That's better. They don't understand the point of view of the CEOs.
So if I'm a champion inside of an organization and I'm bought into this lean thing, I kind of, you know, drawn to it, I get it. And I'm trying to explain to the rest of my executive team, like why this should have a seat at the table or how they should think about it. How would you describe like the goal of lean or how we want to?
Well, first of all, those people are probably going to be in a job for 2 years at a time, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. That's the type of employment that the CI people have, which is not good long-term for their like 401k and retirement to be bouncing around job to job. The difficulty is when a lean person tries to sell the boss on lean, they're going to talk about things like, cost reduction, better teamwork, you know, grow some market share, improve profits and so forth. And it turns out that's only just a small number of the things that concern the bosses. And the way I put it is that there's many preconceptions that leaders have. There are social, economic, political, historical, technological, business, legal, spiritual. There's these different categories of preconceptions. Within each category, there's 10 to 15 preconceptions. So when the lean person stands up there and says, bigger market share, profits, and so forth, they're really talking about business and economic preconceptions, and they're only touching upon a few of those out of several, many others. And so what's left unsaid is, well, how's this going to affect me as the boss? Well, now you got to go do Gemba walks. Well, I don't want to do that. My status is here, and you're telling me to go down there. So they're not addressing, you know, the social preconceptions associated with lean. They're not addressing the historical preconceptions, which is people high up don't do that stuff. You know, the pharaoh doesn't go out to the job site to, you know, inspect the sweaty workers and so forth. They got other people. The thinking is that's their job. They do that stuff. I got pharaoh stuff to do, you know, with my harem, and we got to do some inventory of grain harvest, you know, and what I'm going to tax the people, and I got to conquer that. Pesky nation a couple of hundred kilometers away, you know, they got bigger fish to fry. And I mean, that'll be the typical attitude. So it's very difficult for a lean professional to succeed in the sense of like getting full buy-in of the CEO to go all in and for lean.
So maybe let's take this like middle layer management folks, manager, supervisor type folks who maybe, you know, maybe they get interested in this lean thing and their frame of mind is, hey, I've got a boss that I report to, but I've also got people that report to me and I want to be a good boss and, you know, I want to do a good job with my role. I'm intrigued with this lean thing. What's the best way for somebody like that to think about lean? Like how much of their mental energy should they devote to?
Well, I was faced with this kind of thing, and I've had bosses that are totally not interested in this. They're focused on, did the part arrive on time? You know, are we doing things according to the budget? Are there negative variances or positive variances and so forth? And so a lot of this you have to do as a stealth kind of thing, just improve without making a big fanfare about it. You know, applying some of the lean principles and practices as best you can. So as, you know, when I was a mid-level manager or higher, the thing you did was, you know, you treat your people well, you try to solve problems at the root cause, you try to improve the flow of material and information, but you just don't call it lean and you don't tell the boss too much about it because, you know, they have other concerns about their social standing. Because if the vice president of manufacturing particularly doesn't have the parts in on time, they usually get fired because they're in charge of operations. Now, it's a little bit different for the purchasing vice president because you can sort of make an excuse the supplier failed and they're not in my control. It's not a great excuse and you can't do a lot of that. But there's some preconceptions that people have that, you know, you're probably not going to get fired as the purchasing manager, but more likely to get fired as the operation manager if you can't deliver your, you know, $1 million product or whatever it is.
Interesting. I hear you. I guess part of what I'm picking up is this idea of using this word lean, might not always be the best language to use in certain scenarios, but there's like, you know, maybe kind of go down a level and talk about the things that the business cares about. And then I also heard you.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the language, right? Is there something with the language of lean, even the term of lean, that doesn't always work well?
It doesn't matter what you call it. People can smell a rat. And the rat is that I, as a leader, have to do something different. I have to go to the Gemba. I have to engage with people differently, whether it's in the shop or the office. I have to now base my judgments on people based on, actual performance, not how I think this person is doing or whether I like them or not. You know, I have to gauge their performance against things that I've asked them to do, you know, develop this skill. Okay, have you developed it? Let's see where you are. You know, it's a different type of leader who has different interests. You know, a lot of workers will come up with a neat idea to make the process better or the, you know, particular part of the job better. And they'll be very enthusiastic. And the boss will come by and they'll want to show it to the boss. And the boss, you know, looks at it and then their phone rings and walks away. And you can't do that if you're the so-called lean leader. You got to pay attention to the enthusiasm coming from the workers for improvement and challenge them to say, that's a great improvement. Think about the next one, you know, and so on. And so most leaders don't want to have that kind of engagement.
So, and there's a lot of people out there that have this desire to make things better and evolve, you know, their role, their job, and, you know, they just do a good job. And I've talked to a lot of folks in this lean discipline who didn't know that it was even this lean thing before they, you know, kind of got drawn into it. So I'm curious, what are some of the behaviors, like the specific behaviors, like you use the term go to the Gemba, but what are some of those behaviors that somebody might do or might recommend they do without even calling it lean?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the behaviors are understood in a kind of a rudimentary way, like just courtesy and people's understanding of respect is very limited. So just a quick example, if somebody has their service anniversary at the company, they've been there 30 years, and some bosses might be an extrovert and like to throw a party, but the person who's celebrating their anniversary doesn't like to be the center of attention. They're introverts. And so, you know, you disrespect somebody by making them the center of attention and they have no interest in being the center of attention. So it runs much deeper. That's another thing. It's just respect for people runs very deep, like challenging people. What's your next improvement? Because when you're saying that, you're giving them the opportunity to develop themselves, critical thinking skills, their capabilities. But if you just say that's a nice improvement and walk away, you know, that might be the last improvement you see from them.
Oh, that's such a good example of things that I've heard it said that as a manager, it can be hard to motivate people. It's far easier to just not demotivate them. And that strikes me as like an area where you have the potential to demotivate someone in that scenario.
Not only that, though, you're also, you know, if the worker has been there 20 years and you're the eighth manager that they've seen in 20 years, probably, and you're the one good one that they've seen in 20 years, they're just going to lump all the bad managers onto you that you're probably the same way. And you have to forever prove that you're different. And you'll be given a very short leash as far as screwing up. And so it's a very difficult challenge to do that.
I love this concept of respect because it's one of these things where the word, it sounds so simple. It's a word we've all heard thousands of times, but I think it's also a concept that's really, really deep. And you know, the opportunities to take lessons from it are, you know, infinite. What do people misunderstand about the idea of respect? Like, is respect just being nice to someone?
No, it's not. And there's a famous quote by, I think it was Akio Toyoda, the past president, in one of Jeff Leiker's books, something to the effect that it doesn't mean being nice. It means being honest with people and telling them, you know, a lot of times what they don't want to hear, but it's the truth. It's not a subjective opinion. It's backed by, you know, reality. And so, you know, I get in a lot of trouble for speaking the truth and people don't really understand what I'm doing, which is trying to push people forward and get out of their complacency and lean world and to evolve and advance. And they just look at that as an insult rather than respecting them because I see them wasting their time and their lives doing stuff that doesn't move things forward.
Is there, as a professor, I'm sure you get a chance to teach people, you know, the ways of management and what it means to be a good manager. If I'm somebody who's maybe taking one of your classes or I'm new in a management role, what are a few of those behaviors that you would hope to have me adopt in that role?
Well, let's see if I can show you this. I used to teach an undergraduate course in leadership skills for managers, leadership skills for supervisors at the undergraduate level. I taught other courses at the graduate level. I would give my students at the end of the semester a card, two-sided card, and a pen. And the theme on the pens and cards varied over the years. But let's see if you can see that. Can you read what that card says?
I can't quite read it. I see a picture, but I can't quite see what it says
on
the card.
Let's see if we can zoom in on it. And it's really not going to show up well. The card says, hey, don't be an a-hole supervisor, okay? And then the pen says, Professor Bob Emiliani, and below it, it says, don't forget the stuff I taught you. You know, and I had a number of different visual controls that I would give to students to try to get across key points. So a lot of stuff like that. What people tend to focus on is the behaviors, and that's a mistake. It's not gotten us really anywhere in the last 100 years when people started to focus on leadership behaviors and what are the requisite behaviors. And I've been pushing people forward. It's like, you need to look at the preconceptions because we've been doing this behavior stuff for better than a century, and you still have leadership in corporations that a lot of people are dissatisfied with. You know, when they do the surveys, who is it that does the surveys about employee engagement? Gallup. So the surveys always show, or in recent times, show declining employee engagement, worse leadership, and so forth. But why are we focused on behaviors? It's a, you know, billion-dollar industry for leadership development. What's it getting us?
You used the term preconceptions just a minute ago. I'm curious if you could drill down on what you mean by that preconception and how that can actually be a better place to focus on, it sounds like.
Good question. A preconception is a preconceived notion formed prior to experience in the absence of reasoning. Okay, so it's formed prior to experience in the absence of reasoning. Okay, so this means, you know, like you heard it from somebody, you haven't experienced it, you don't know for sure, but yet you have this idea of this is the way things should be. And these things start to come in at us at a very young age. And we start to learn about management at a very young age because our parents are our first managers. Our pediatrician is our healthcare manager. Our little league coach is our soccer, football, baseball manager. And so we start to learn through these associations, which involved a lot of preconceptions, because a coach might have the preconception to get people to perform, you got to be tough on them. So the coach is tough on the little leaguers, and the little leaguers then think you need to be tough on people, but it's just a transferal of preconceptions is what's going on here. And so you really need to dig down into these things.
Are there some questions that come to mind for you, or as leaders and managers, we should be asking ourselves to expose some of these things?
Absolutely. And there's things like, you know, traditions. Do we ever ask when it has a tradition outlived its usefulness? You know, why are we still doing it this way?
I love this story of, you know, the mom who cuts the end off the ham, you know, because that's just the way that we've always done it.
Yeah. Yeah. We stick to those traditions, and we don't question why we do those things. We don't question why we do the work that way. We don't question our traditions. And those traditions are policies and procedures in the company. One of the things that people just don't grasp, that's very well grasped within Toyota world, is times change, customers change, colors change, tastes change, everything changes. Tomorrow's different than today. The newspaper headline tomorrow is different than today. So you have to keep up with the times. And in a lot of companies, the style of leadership doesn't keep up with times. The way managers manage the day-to-day activity doesn't keep up with the times. The product development doesn't keep up with the times. I mean, it's legendary. Southwest Airlines for years flew one type of aircraft and had quick turnarounds. And for a couple of decades, a big major airline said that Herb Kelleher's nuts and there's no reason to do that. And they just kept doing the same thing. They didn't question why they did what they did. Here's another example of that. Anyway, there's numerous examples of where just people don't question things and you end up in a bad place.
That's interesting.
Times change. You got to keep up with the times. That's what Kaizen is trying to do. improve every day, either a little bit or a lot, doesn't matter, but improve every day.
It sounds like the, you know, I know in the lean or continuous improvement discipline, the behavior patterns that come to mind for these things are like daily huddles and Gemba walks and tier meetings and stuff like this. Are these some of the rituals that people would look to implement? And, you know, again, just the, like the tool.
I see them as bureaucratization. Mm. So the classical management has invaded these other things and bureaucratized them and made them. I remember somebody at a conference asked Shiro Nakao once, you know, how do you know if the company's if the work is improving? What metric do you use? And he's like, you got to learn to use your eyes. But quit looking at the numbers. I mean, you're good at looking at the numbers. It's what you do all the time. What you don't do is you don't see. You need to learn how to see what's going on and to see what the improvements are. Or how do you know if employees are happy or not? You need to see with your eyes. And so I think a lot of, you know, what's happened is, as I said earlier, that the lean tools and methods have been co-opted by classical management. These are deemed to be a threat because they impinge upon leaders' status, rights, and privileges. And so what happens is they get, you know, enclosed in the classical management way of thinking. Many people today refer to it as a Kaizen project. It's not the Kaizen project, it's just Kaizen. When you call it a project, most people recoil because it's like, I got enough projects to work on. Why am I doing other projects? So it's just the whole, you know, classical management has infected the lean way of thinking to the detriment of lean, but definitely to the benefit of, you know, the people who favor classical management. They've neutralized the benefit that could be had by even the derivative interpretation known as lean.
You touched on something just a minute ago I want to come back to, and I think it's one of the benefits of lean thinking is the definition of value and who decides what is valuable. I'm curious if you could talk to that a little bit and perception of who the customer is or what the customer wants.
Yeah, you need to do that. You need to understand what the customer perceives as value. There's different sort of ends at which this operates within a company. There is, of course, the sales people, the marketing people. If you have distributors, end use customers, you know, you need to talk to all these people in that chain to find out what they perceive as value. But you also need to be ahead of them, because I did not know I wanted a heated steering wheel until I got one. Yeah, that's pretty good. I like a heated steering wheel. So you got to kind of be ahead of what customers want. And then there's sort of the other end of it. The people who are actually producing the product and service, they're not really focused on value. And this is the mistake the lean world made by shifting the focus of TPS on waste, identify waste, eliminate the sources of waste, and so forth. Because if you're in the factory and you're machining a part, you don't understand how that machine part presents value in the eyes of the customer, right? Customer is buying, let's just stick with Toyota's case, a car, but could be a camera, a cell phone, whatever. There's parts of the business that need to look at the value proposition for a customer, and then there's parts that need to look at the waste. You have to do both.
Is there too much focus on the waste? I mean, is that?
It depends where you are. And if you're in the lean realm or in the, you know, Toyota realm, it depends. And it depends where you are in that company. You see, I think what you're driving at is, you know, when people focus too much on waste and cost reduction, things go awry. But there's more than that that's happening. It's not just the terminology and that particular focus that causes the problem. There is an entrenched way of thinking loaded with different preconceptions across different categories that does not see the sensibility of lean or TPS.
In this, you know, mental models of all of this stuff that we can spend our time thinking about and studying and, you know, improving ourselves as managers and humans generally, you've got things like lean and theory of constraints and balanced scorecard and classical management. I'm curious if the idea of a balanced scorecard, if not like the literal implementation, but the concept of it, of course, you know, every business needs to make some money and generate revenue, because otherwise all the other things that are nice about a business aren't able to happen. What are some of the perspectives that, you know, does lean fit into a balanced scorecard type perspective in a way that, you know, is useful?
I don't know. And I don't know that much about balanced scorecard. What I do know, though, is when you create cells to do the work, whether it's service type of work or manufacturing kind of work, what you're measuring is cycle time, rate of customer demand, lead time, fundamental measures that you would be focused on in Kaizen activities. And then you would focus on the input costs related to that cell and the overhead related to that cell, cost per square footage, the machinery, whether you're amortizing it and so forth. And just a much simpler way to measure performance on a cell by cell basis.
Like work, individual work cell, like how's this cell performing its intended
yeah,
job?
All costs. See, what typically happened in an old factory is the cost would be determined by the aggregate of the factory, people, plant property, equipment, electricity, you know, everything, square footage. And what happens in, Toyota world is the costs early on, by the way, not so much recently, the costs are allocated directly to the work cells. And you don't do the so-called peanut butter spread of the overhead across every work area. The overhead is particular to individual work areas that have, you know, some may have machinery that's 100 years old, that there's virtually no overhead. And then others might have the latest $10 million machine. So the overheads are different for those two different areas, and you shouldn't combine them because that's one of the things that Toyota would go into a company who's making their parts and say, and look at their numbers and say, well, why am I paying for that $10 million machine that I don't use? That's some other customer of yours. My work passes across these cells, and so I'll pay with your profit margin for what's actually being done here, and charge that customer the overhead for that thing that you bought over there, which you shouldn't have bought to begin with because you didn't need it.
That's so interesting. I'm trying to think of how many conversations are probably happening somewhere right now this time of year, you know, going into like budget season about budgets and allocations of overhead and who should pay for what. quite interesting. Okay, you touched a little bit about metrics and measurements, and I'm kind of finding maybe there's like a right balance of you can't necessarily just look at the numbers. You have to have some numbers in this idea of what metrics are good and maybe some examples of bad metrics. You can take that from either side. What are some things that are good to measure in a truly
earned hours is bad. Machine utilization is bad in a manufacturing setting. There's really too many I did a blog post once called Metrics Madness, and I developed that material by asking my students, what measure are you held accountable to? These are graduate students, full-time working professionals, right? So, 5 to 25 years of experience. What metric are you held accountable to in one column? What is the benefit of that metric according to your boss? And what does that metric actually do to you in terms of your work? And so it turns out that there's a metric that the boss thinks has a favorable impact, but the workers are gaming in some way, shape, or form. So, and the bosses, again, they stick with tradition. Purchase price variance in the purchasing world or standard costs or something like that. And they don't realize the games that people are playing with those metrics to be able to meet them, but the parts are late to the customer, or the quality is wrong, and so forth. And a lot of times, not less so lately, but a lot of times, like the purchasing vice president came from purchasing, played those purchase price variance metrics themselves, but then they're still running that silo according to purchase price variance metric, knowing full well that it's a bad metric.
You mentioned a couple other ones. What was the, did you say earned hours?
Earned hours.
Talk about that one just a little bit.
I'll see if I can remember it. You're making a part, and if you make that part according to the standard, you earn X number of labor hours for having produced that part. And what you want to be able to do is produce your part within your budget of earned hours.
I see.
So if you have some market basket of parts that you're producing and it represents so many hours, let's say 1 million hours to produce annually that market basket of parts, then you have absorbed your overheads and so forth and produced according to the right metric of earned hours. But if instead it takes you 20% more, then you have an unfavorable labor metric you're taking more labor than necessary to produce the parts. Well, that could be because the volume and mix changed of the parts, but it kind of doesn't matter because it doesn't break down so simply as that in the aggregate measure of earned hours. And so you get beat up as the factory manager for having a bad earned hours metric.
Are you familiar with this Goodhart's law? When the metric becomes the target, it ceases to become a good metric.
I'm vaguely familiar with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to be careful. I mean, these people don't question metrics. And are they driving the right thinking? Number one, which the thinking ought to be, is the customer getting what they want, when they want it, and the amount wanted, et cetera, a la just in time? Or are we just doing this internally for our internal gamesmanship?
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com.
So is there
to get our bonus as the boss?
How should we be thinking about, I mean, whether it's lean or just business improvement broadly inside of our organizations, are there some questions that we should be asking ourselves as we set up these metrics, as we work against these metrics to avoid falling into that trap of achieving the target but not achieving the big picture?
Well, it's difficult in a big business, you know, because a big business may measure itself by a purchase price variance, and to get that to change is going to the board of directors, and that affects how you report out to the state and federal government and things like that. That's not to say you shouldn't do it. Of course you should do it, because purchase price variance drives neither the right thinking nor the right behaviors. Some people call it material price variance. It really should be planned versus actual, you know? But anyway, it can be difficult because it's got to get board of directors level approval. And then you got a board of directors where their companies are all, the board members, their companies all do purchase price variance metric. They're like, why do you want to change it? Why do you got to be different?
I think that sounds like one of these red flags in business review conversations, because that's the way we've always done it. That on itself should send up a little bit of a, what was it called? A check of your preconceptions.
Yeah, you're right. But these things should be under constant review. Is this still serving us well? Is this driving the right thinking? Does this drive the right behaviors? Is the customer getting what they wanted, you know, when they want it, the way they want it, and so forth? And a lot of those conversations, what people like to do is do something and be done with it, and step away from it. And they don't like to revisit it. And then when a new manager comes in and has the thinking that, yeah, we should be revisiting these things all the time, they're like, who's this idiot?
Yeah.
You know, we have something that works. Why do you want to change it?
Yeah. You know, whatever the cadence is, whatever the meeting is where that's being asked, you know, is this still serving us? I like that as a, that's a great question. It's a very good insight. And who is the customer? Who are we trying to serve here? Is it somebody in payroll because, you know, we're trying to make the bonus or something? That's an interesting question.
Or we're trying to minimize the work. You know, standard costs came about to minimize the work for accountants.
So interesting.
And yeah, it happened in the you know, early 90s. A lot of how businesses are run today was based upon what was developed in the early 90s when you did manual calculations. You don't do manual calculations anymore. So there's no reason to use standard costs and earned hours and stuff like that.
You're probably familiar with Nick Katko and his work on,
yes,
on the financial accounting. Yeah, his skin crawls when you use a standard cost.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense anymore, but this is what it's still getting taught in school. And the professors will say, well, we teach it because that's what's in industry. And so you're in this doom loop.
So speaking of doom loops, we're in this age of AI where AI is going to change everything, right? It's going to, you know, and it's potentially going to lay people off. How should somebody who's trying to use, let's say, real lean or, you know, be a lean thinker, what are your thoughts on how AI is going to change things, or how to use lean in this like AI tsunami that's coming at us?
Yeah, I don't know. Good question. I'm not sure yet. I mean, what the Lean Enterprise Institute had a webinar with Art Smalley basically presenting an AI tool for lean tools. So I thought it was absurd, because now you have a tool for the tools, which didn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know. I mean, time will tell. Relative to Lean, I don't think it's doing too much so far. But I mean, otherwise, AI can be very helpful depending on what you do with it and how, you know, you have to treat this with some skepticism and double check, you know, facts or check the facts or check what it has produced to make sure it's factual and so forth. But I mean, for sure, we're headed down that path, whether we like it or not.
I'm curious, you know, in talking to a lot of people about Lean, one of the tenets and pillars, respect for people, respect for humanity, and the idea of, you know, you put all this time and energy into your workforce and making them good at solving problems and adding value, however you like to refer to it. It seems like there's an opportunity for people to practice that discipline with all the change that's coming at us in Lean.
Yes. It seems like there is that opportunity. But one of the things that people high in status don't like is a lot of fast change. Now, we're seeing that they like a lot of fast change when it comes to AI, but we're also seeing that they're in the driver's seat when it comes to this change. So change can happen quickly when high status people are driving it, but otherwise they don't like fast change coming from the bottom up. That's been one of the problems with Lean. Because in Kaizen, you go from batch to flow, for example, you know, and that's a lot of change happening all at once. And that, you know, that confuses a leader. It shows they've been poor managers because we've been talking about flow production for 40, 50, 60 years, you know, long time going back to Henry Ford, if you think in that assembly line model. And so we have an interesting phenomenon with AI because the high status people are in charge of that and going to be driving change for low status people. And I'm not sure that Lean has much of a capacity to contend with that.
I'm curious, with your knowledge as a historian of, I mean, you know, literally going back thousands of years of work, if there's a strong parallel to things in the past that you say, oh, this, you know, this AI thing looks a lot like this other major shift that has happened. Is there anything like that?
Yeah, it looks like the Industrial Revolution again, where...
What are the lessons from that that we should carry forward?
You should be more generous with prosperity than you were in the past. You know, what this thing looks like is poised to do is just massive unemployment. And the two things that concern the high status people the most are taxes and the angry mob. And so I guess the question is going to be, what are you going to take, higher taxes or the angry mob? Because one of those is coming your way.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, we hear this all the time when we think about history. You know, it may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so
rhymes pretty well, remarkably well at times. Because fundamentally, we're humans with this thinking that extends certain parts of the way we think about interacting with people, about commerce, trade. You know, because the Egyptian pharaohs were business people. They had to be concerned with trade, get their cut of the action and all of this stuff, and decide who to let in the country, who to kick out, you know, the whole thing. They're not just the rulers of a land. They're business people, too. They're the first business people. I mean, the Holocene period, probably Mesopotamia, but there's no written record. The written record starts with Egypt. And so, you know, the thinking then is a lot the same as now in this realm of business.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm so curious to see how some of these things are going to play out, for sure.
I just to say one quick thing. I mean, you can imagine the king, when he decides he doesn't like some other king, wants to go to war. Well, he's got to spend a few years rounding up a lot of a certain kind of feather for arrows, a certain kind of sticks for arrows, you know? And then if there's some technology, like you can catapult boiling oil on him or whatever, that's better, because it takes a long time to round up all these arrows, make the feathers and make the arrows and make the pointers. And so they're always looking to reduce labor and labor costs for making these things, you know, so it's nothing new.
That's so interesting. So I'll move into a little section here, refer to this as the rapid fire. These are just kind of some quick questions and just kind of top of mind answers here. So the most important job of a leader is to blank.
Take an interest in, you know, material and information flow. Take an interest in people's ideas for eliminating waste or improving customer value. You know, be curious.
Take
an interest in those kind of things. Yeah.
I know it's not all about the tools, but is there a tool that you find yourself turning to most frequently?
Not a tool, a method. Toyota's Toyota style Kaizen, creative Kaizen.
Kaizen.
That's,
I love what you said about
the, you know, that's the thing people should have focused on from the beginning, but they didn't. They didn't understand it. And by the way, all these so-called lean tools come out of Kaizen practice. You know, what I tell people is, why are you using the lean tools out of context? Do Kaizen, then you'll be using the lean tools within so-called lean tools, or actually Toyota tool in contact, whatever.
You've got 28 books. If you're going to recommend one of those to our audience who might not be familiar with your work, where would they start?
Triumph of Classical Management over Lean Management. Reason why is people get involved with lean before understanding what they're up against. They need to know what they're up against.
Excellent. Finish this sentence. Lean is?
Seductive. It'll blind you to reality. The reality of leadership, leaders, what they like, what they want to achieve socially, how lean interferes with that.
So interesting. Do you have a favorite question?
Yeah, how can I help you?
That's a great one. And what do you get most, what are you fired up about? What do you get most excited about? What are you excited about right now?
Continue my research into understanding why most leaders resist, reject, or ignore progressive management. So I've done, you know, written 6 books about that. I've stopped writing books. It's showing up in blog posts now, but I'm still researching that. You know, I looked at it from 6 different directions. And so, and there's a 7th, you know, corporate finance, basically mergers and acquisitions are a lot more interesting to CEOs than lean is. And particularly from a social perspective, because that gets your name in the paper and lean doesn't.
That's interesting. What is something that you believe that you feel others tend to disbelieve?
So I've provided far better explanations of why leaders resist, reject, or ignore lean management than have ever existed before, going back to the time of Frederick Taylor, because he faced the same problem. His guys and ladies, Lillian Gilbreth, faced the same problem, that leaders were not that interested in that stuff. And so, but people still cling to, you know, the leaders are, they're not engaged. The leaders blame people for, you know, the superficial stuff. They're still focused on the superficial understanding of causality. And they have yet to reckon with the deeper levels of causality that I present. Some have, of course, but as by and large for the lean community, they have not. And that includes the lean movement leaders as well.
Well, I think that your understanding and knowledge of the history of classical management, lean, all this stuff, I find that super interesting. And I've been, super pleased to get introduced to you and to read some of your works and to follow you on LinkedIn. And I would encourage others to. Is LinkedIn the best place to get in touch with you or follow you if anybody wants?
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. Yep. That works. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Bob, thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast. We're super happy to have you with us.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a guest, ask a question, or have an idea for an episode, please, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode, if you haven't enjoyed the episode, be sure and add a comment. If you have a question about any of this stuff, feel free to ask a question to Bob or I in the comments, and we'll make sure that it gets through to Bob if you address it to him. And please share the podcast with your friends or colleagues who are passionate about lean or continuous improvement or leadership in general. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.